Hello, everybody. Welcome. Good to see you. I can't see you so well, but I'm glad you're here back on the screen. So what I want to talk about tonight is one of my favorite topics. It's the three characteristics or the three marks. So, you know, Buddha had all these lists. I love that because that logical way of thinking sort of appeals to me. But one of the shorter lists is the three characteristics. And I want to, you can think about them universally and in a macro way, or you could think about them really up to the minute. And I'm trying to think about them very like second by second. I'm going to try to describe it that way and things you might want to try, because that's sort of what I've been working on myself. You know, if I talk to somebody who doesn't follow Buddhism and say, what are the three characteristics? They say, well, first one's impermanence. I say, yeah, I got that one. Things change. Duh. You know? And then the second one is unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, suffering. I say, yeah, you know, life can be tough. I get that one. And then we get to the third one and they say, no self. And they say, what, are you crazy? Of course there's a self. But anyway, Buddha didn't think so. So I'll talk about these in order. First one is impermanence. Buddha thought these topics were really important. In fact, he made in the Dhammapada, he has this statement in there. Better it is to live one day seeing the rise and fall of things than to live 100 years without ever seeing the rise and fall of things. That's quite a statement, one day versus 100 years. So just think what you can do in one day. You can accomplish more than what a lot of people do in 100 years. So on the macro level, we can see that things are impermanent. You know, we're told that galaxies are born and die. The earth eventually will cease to exist. Civilizations arise and pass away. Days come and go. When we meditate, we watch each breath come and go. As we meditate, can we see that each breath comes and goes? Are we really looking that carefully at impermanence? Doing this in a very microscopic way has been helpful to me, and that's the way I like to do it. In addition, I'd like to shift your focus to the unchanging backdrop upon which all these things arise and pass away. It's an interesting way to notice things arising and passing away. If you look closely, you may be able to see the unchanging, silent stillness that's present in each moment. Have you ever tried to do that? You know, so you're meditating, and then behind whatever it is you're mindful of, there's this unchanging thing, this unchanging stillness or presence. It's really hard to describe. I'm not even sure it is describable. But it's kind of like at a movie screen on which colors of the film are projected. It's calm, unreactive, peaceful, never changing. For me, it's useful to examine impermanence as the moment-to-moment variations of life that occur on this unchanging screen. There's this blank, and then stuff's changing all the time. And I like doing it. It's enjoyable, and I think it's useful because it's a different way. So right now, if you notice your body touching your seat, can you look past the sense of touch right now as you're sitting to the peaceful stillness that is the knower of your sensations? There is something that's knowing that your back's touching the chair, that your feet are touching the floor. Now notice the sensations of each breath. Again, can you look past the sensations of breath to the peaceful stillness that is the knower of the sensations of the breath? This peaceful stillness is the same no matter what type of sensation you have. I've been having fun trying to play with that for a while. Some sensations are painful. You have a trip to the dentist. You know, things hurt. And if you're willing to notice it, there's still this calm, peaceful thing behind it. If you allow yourself to feel that instead of the pain, or a broken collarbone. Some of you know I broke my collarbone last October, and you know, it hurt quite a bit. And when I was mindful enough, you know, sometimes I just, the pain just, you know, I wasn't paying attention, but if I was mindful, you could see the stillness, the quiet, the peacefulness that was happening behind it. Some sensations are joyful, like a beautiful sunset. If you allow yourself in a moment of joy to just notice that stillness, it's still there. Or time spent with a loved one, or whatever you find as a pleasant experience, that stillness is still there. As we are mindful of each thing that arises and passes away in each second of our lives, we can also see the unchanging backdrop, which allows us to notice the changes that occur on top of that backdrop. If there wasn't something unchanging, I'm not sure that knowing the things that do change, even in a very microscopic way, would be possible. So one of my favorite authors, as some of you know, is, it wasn't really an author, but a teacher, Nisargadatta, in a book called I Am That. He basically was just questions and answers. He said this, which really relates. I think many of the things he says are just so close to being Buddhist. I don't think he was a Buddhist, but you know, it doesn't really matter. In reality, there's only the source, dark in itself, making everything shine. Unperceived, it causes perception. Unfelt, it causes feeling. Unthinkable, it causes thought. Non-being, it gives birth to being. It is the immovable background of motion. Once you are there, you are at home everywhere. Which is an interesting way to think about it. So that calm thing that doesn't move, some people might call it the deathless. In the Dhammapada, again, Buddha says, better is it to live one day seeing the deathless than to live 100 years without ever seeing the deathless. So paying attention to these things, according to Buddha and Nisargadatta and others, is an important thing. So that's the first one, impermanence. It's not just like, oh yeah, things change. Can you pay attention to things like second by second by second? Try it when you're taking a walk or doing anything. So the second one, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha. I like the translation unsatisfactoriness better than suffering, because most of us are not in a state of what we think the word suffering means very often. Sometimes, but you know, unsatisfactoriness makes sense. With this characteristic, I again want to focus on the moment-to-moment aspect of unsatisfactoriness. In the macro view, we can see that the world is often unfair. Wars cause untold suffering, illness, old age, death, Brian talked about a little bit last week, are clearly unsatisfactory. But now carefully, can you see how unsatisfactoriness affects you moment to moment? So I'm going to give you an exercise. And if you've, some of you may have, I think one or two of you that I see have taken the class that I teach with Kathy. So this might be a review, but for a lot of you, it's not. I want to tell you about an exercise, and I do this exercise pretty often, that Jack Kornfield suggested at a retreat that I attended that he was the teacher of. Jack Kornfield's been a teacher of Vipassana for a long time. So here's the exercise, and you can imagine it even if you haven't done it. And this is what I mean by moment to moment. Can you see unsatisfactoriness? Some morning, when you have several hours that are not committed, start this exercise as soon as you wake up. Here it is. You can do anything you want to do, but you must notice each time you move a muscle. Then notice why you move that muscle. So it's simple, but you have to really be paying attention to make that happen. What is unsatisfactory that makes you want to move? If things were perfect, would you have a whole morning, you have 2 hours, you can do whatever you want. things were exactly the way you wanted, you wouldn't even move. So why are you moving? So it may go something like this. First, you wake up and say, oh yeah, I'm going to do this thing today. And you roll over. In that microscopic moment, why do you roll over? It's unsatisfactory. You know, it'd be better if I was on this side instead of that side. It's not suffering, but it's unsatisfactoriness that makes you change. Then you get out of bed because you don't want to spend the whole 2 hours laying in bed. And then if you're like me, one of the first things you do is go to the bathroom. There is an unsatisfactoriness in having to go. So, you know, the pleasant and unpleasant are kind of two sides of the same coin. So it's unpleasant to have to go. It's pleasant when you do. Then you flush the toilet. You're moving your muscle to do that because you don't want to leave it there because of the unpleasantness now and in the future if it stays there a long time. And then you're thirsty. You get a drink of water. I mean, think of what's happening. You're being led along experience by experience because of some unsatisfactoriness. I'm thirsty, I get a drink. You brush your teeth because your mouth feels lousy after being asleep all night. Maybe you make some coffee or tea. Why are you doing that? Well, you know, it feels better. Maybe have breakfast, clean dishes. I mean, you can go on and notice each little thing. Like, why are you moving your hand? Because I want to make tea. Why are you moving the cup up to your mouth? Because I want to drink it. I don't want it just to sit there in the cup. Then you're done with all that. And you sit in a chair. And you're bored. So you do whatever your favorite thing to do is when you're bored. You either read a book or go take a walk. Walk the dog, call a friend, watch TV, see a movie, whatever you want to do. But everything you did in that 2 hours, you were led because something wasn't as good as you wanted it to be, so you changed it by moving. That's an exercise that I think is really worth doing, to see how just moment by moment by moment, unsatisfactoriness moves you from something you find relatively unpleasant to something that you find relatively pleasant. That's way different than looking at the macro picture. So there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with, that you have to move all the time. Really, all it's doing is telling you that Buddha was right. Life has unsatisfactoriness. And so one way to see it is to actually look at what you do moment to moment to moment. And that's the, my focus here is having people pay attention as much as possible to the moment to moment impermanence, moment to moment unsatisfactoriness. Okay, the next topic, no self. This is the one that if you say that to people, they say, hey, you're crazy. Of course there's a self. I wake up every day, I look in the mirror, that's me. There's a Joseph Goldstein used to tell the story about Nasruddin, who's sort of like this fool character that they use. And so he goes into a bank and he needs to cash a check. So he gives the teller a check and the teller says, well, can you identify yourself? And he pulls out a mirror and he says, yep, that's me. Doesn't work at a bank, but. So the notion of self is a concept. In Vipassana, we're trying to see things clearly and be able to look past concepts to see what is real. Can we deconstruct our concepts and look what remains? Look at what remains when the concept is gone. This is one way to approach no self, which is kind of a hard thing to talk about. So again, Joseph Goldstein, I went to a number of retreats early on and when I was meditating, and every retreat I went to, he brought up this example. And it's the example of the Big Dipper. So go out into the sky at night, look up into the direction of the Big Dipper and see if you can see it. It's the easiest constellation. It's like the only one I really know. And there are 7 stars. They kind of look like they're together from where we are, but they're really not even close to each other at all. They're like, millions of light years apart. But there's this thing that looks like a Big Dipper. That's a concept. There's a Big Dipper in the sky. So to get a sense of how these concepts pull us and our feel like solid, go out some night and look in the direction up there and try to not see the Big Dipper. I can't do it. I look up there and my brain says Big Dipper, even though I know it's just seven stars that happen to be, you know, and in a pattern, and people have called it that. So the concept has solidified in our minds. And when concepts solidify, it's sometimes difficult to deconstruct them. Sometimes it's not even useful. I mean, seeing the Big Dipper and saying, okay, that's the Big Dipper, nothing wrong with that. You know, another example is a car. You know, a car consists of many parts. We call it a car. And as we know, you know, it has, you know, tires, doors, hood, seating, steering wheel, engine, brakes. And we use the word car, which is a useful thing to say, because you wouldn't want to have to go through the list of all the parts every time you wanted to say, hey, jump in my, and say that whole list. You want to just say, jump in my car. So it's useful. Now apply the same idea of deconstruction to yourself. Now it gets a little weirder. What are you? Well, as a conscious being, your entire world is made up of six things that you've done since you've been born. Only six things. See, hear, taste, touch, smell, and think. Thinking broadly defined as any mental movement. Have you ever done anything else? Have you ever done it in any time that is not right now? You've done six things and you've always done them in the present moment. And when it's in the past, it becomes a mind movement because it's a memory. When you're thinking about the future, it's a mind movement because you're planning or contemplating the future. So the arrival of the self is related to the ever-present urge to move away from unpleasant toward pleasant, which is what we talked about in the unsatisfactoriness. These three characteristics are intertwined, I think. Nisargadatta put it this way. He said a couple of things here. Self-identification with the body creates ever-fresh desires, and there is no end to them. Unless this mechanism of bondage is clearly seen, it is clarity that is liberating, for you cannot abandon desire unless its causes and effects are clearly seen. Okay, he goes on to say, find the true meaning of me and mine, which is what we're talking about, the self, and you will be free of all bondage. Same thing Buddha says, there's no self. You have a mind which is spread in time. One after another, things happen to you and memory remains. There's nothing wrong with it. The problem arises only when the memory of past pains and pleasures, which is essential to all organic life, to have the memory of past pains and pleasures so you don't go around hurting yourself. So the problem arises only when the memory of past pains and pleasures remains as a reflex dominating behavior, which I think it does. This reflex takes the shape of I and uses the body and the mind for its purposes, which are invariably in search of pleasure or flight from pain. When you recognize the I as it is, a bundle of desires and fears, and the sense of mine as embracing all things and people needed for the purposes of avoiding pain and securing pleasure, you will see that the I and the mind are false ideas, having no foundation in reality, created by the mind. They rule their creator as long as he takes them to be true. When questioned, they dissolve. Now, I'm not under any illusion that me talking about this for 5 minutes or you reading books for 20 years is going to make this clear. You know, I'm working on it and continue to work on it myself, but it's useful to hear this stuff. It's useful to think about the possibility of the no self. And there are certain authors and certain teachers that talk about it really well. And I think it's useful for it to be part of your knowledge set. If you watch carefully, you may be able to see the arising of this sense I in each moment. Each moment, the I comes up. It's created over and over again and becomes a concept that is useful, but not based on clarity. So the I is a concept. What else was a concept? The car was a concept. The Big Dipper was a concept. If you think it's difficult to look up in the sky and not see the Big Dipper, then how much more difficult is it to not see the I when looking at our experience? Maybe a million times harder? I don't know. This is an extraordinarily difficult task, but it's possible. We know it's possible because people before us have done it. And I think this is the real, some of the real meat of what Buddha talked about and other teachers. So when thinking about these three characteristics, try to think about them experientially as much as possible. Impermanence you can do experientially, I think. We talked about some ways to do that. I mean, my favorite way, so I'm recapping here, is to notice the unchanging thing behind every experience you have, and then notice the movements that happen on top of that, second by second. Unsatisfactoriness. Notice how you do things each second to make things, to avoid pain and do pleasant things. I was taking a walk this afternoon, right after I'd been thinking about this. And I noticed I was walking in the woods and there's a bunch of rocks and stuff. And I noticed my foot, you know, normally if I was on pavement, I'd walk straight. So I've moved a little to the left to avoid a rock. Why? Because of the memory of stepping on rocks incorrectly and the pain that it can cause. So, I mean, it's just a natural part of being human. So I moved, then I moved back. And tiny little things were getting me to avoid unpleasantness and to keep things pleasant. And then no self. Well, the no self is a hard one to do. Just realize how simple it is. All you've ever done is to see, hear, taste, touch, smell, or think. And you've done it only in the now. That's been your experience. And with that, you've built up this concept of self. And little by little, if you keep at it, you can sort of begin to chip away at that. And in fact, Nisargadatta had another thing. I don't have the quote here, but he says, you start chipping away at it. You're like a little chick in a shell. And you start, you know, you chip here and there's a little bit of light and then kind of goes away. And you chip here and chip there. And pretty soon it might open up. And this idea of no self may be more than just some theory that's difficult to understand. So even if all these ideas are not completely clear, and they're probably not, don't abandon attempting to understand them. Buddha considered them essential. Be patient and keep trying. One last quote from the Buddha from the Dhammapada. Better it is to live one day wise and meditative than to live 100 years foolish and uncontrolled. So what's his definition of wise and meditative? One of them is to pay attention to these three characteristics or three marks. So one day of that, you've beaten 100 years of not doing it. Doesn't sound too bad. So that's really, that's what I have to say for tonight. Thank you for your attention. There are some, well, I was told to make one announcement and then there may be some others. So we've been working on sort of moving the website for FIMC, Flagstaff Insight Meditation Community, to a different platform.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.